WBH Sports Radio. I'm your host, William Holly. Thank you for tuning in to episode number 37. Here recorded on the great campus of Brooklyn College. Special shout out to the students here at the radio station for holding me down. Now, I'm excited about this episode. A few things I want to get into from the NFL weekend. I want to talk about the New York Yankees advancing in the Major League Baseball playoffs. But first, did you guys see the latest clip of The Shop? That's LeBron James' show that he puts together on HBO. They had California State Governor Gavin Newsom on. And Mr. Newsom signed the Fair Pay to Play Act right there on the show. That is a bill that will allow California college athletes to monetize and capitalize off their name, image, and likeness, essentially paying college athletes. Now, I don't want to debate whether or not they should be compensated. We could do that in the future. What I do want to ask is, what's LeBron James's issue with the NCAA? Why does it seem like he's on a crusade to make them change their business practices? Now, WBH Sports Radio, we asking the tough questions. So, which college did LeBron James play for? Which NCAA institution capitalized off LeBron's unpaid labor? None. He didn't go to college. He didn't go to college. So why does it seem like it's his mission to tackle them? When LeBron James was in high school and his high school eligibility was in jeopardy because he received some throwback jerseys from a local business, that wasn't the NCAA. When LeBron James received a brand new Hummer H2 $60,000 vehicle and they wanted to suspend him, that wasn't the NCAA. When LeBron James's high school basketball games became so popular that they had to be moved from his high school gym to the local college to accommodate all of those new paying fans, that wasn't the NCAA that pocketed that money. When his high school games were played on pay-per-view for the local Ohio area, that wasn't the NCAA that put that money in their pocket. So my issue with LeBron's crusade against the NCAA and everybody else's, it's incomplete. If you want to change the landscape and compensate amateur athletes, there are a lot more culprits than just the NCAA. It's short-sighted just to point the finger at them. If you want to revamp the system, let's tackle the whole thing. There are a lot of people getting by on these talented, unpaid amateur athletes. And I'm just confused at why everybody's pointing the finger at one person. When you do that, you let all the other culprits off the hook. There is a high school here in New York City. It's called Christ the King Regional High School. It's right there in Queens, New York. That is the place two-time NBA champion Lamar Odom played his high school basketball. That is the place where WNBA great Sue Bird played high school basketball. Tina Charles. They have a rich tradition of great athletics. And it's a school that's sponsored by LeBron James and Nike and the athletes. They wear his paraphernalia. And in fact, I was reading an article in Sports Illustrated, September 4th, 2018. LeBron James stopped by. He donated a new locker room to them. Okay. And to commemorate, I guess, his affiliation and a new locker room, Nike released the LeBron James 3 Christ the King edition, with the Christ the King colors, the Christ the King logo. And within minutes, it sold out. That's not the NCAA capitalizing off the great history of Christ the King. That's not the NCAA capitalizing off the unpaid labor of those great athletes at Christ the King. In fact, that's you, LeBron. You're just as guilty as the NCAA. That's you, LeBron, that slaps your logo on the Ohio State athletes. And of course, with you affiliated with Ohio State, the paraphernalia flies off the shelf. You're just as complicit. You're no different than NCAA. Hey, I'm going to donate a locker room to Christ the King, and boom, watch my sneakers fly off the shelf. That's you capitalizing off the rich tradition, off the winning ways of Christ the King. So you know better. You know different. So in my opinion, it makes sense why everybody wants to send the crowd to the NCAA, because it lets guys like you off the hook. When you were in high school and you were on the cover of Slam Magazine with the great Sebastian Telfair, two high schoolers that didn't go to the NBA, that wasn't the NCAA that was capitalizing off those magazines being sold. If you want to change the system, let's change the whole thing. Because listen, if making money off of these athletes is the crime, right? If that's the bank heist, well, shit, the NCAA ain't nothing but the getaway driver. They just a peon in this whole thing. Those kids have been exploited long before they get to college. And shit, some of them don't ever go to college, like you, LeBron. So I'm just puzzled. You're letting so many people off the hook, including Nike. Nike goes around and they sponsor these AAU teams, and they have a national tournament that brings all these teams together. It's called Nike Peach Jam. Guess what? The tickets are $15. Them kids ain't making that money. Now, you might say, well, Will, they can't pay the kids because it would jeopardize their ability to play for the NCAA. Okay. Last year, one of the most highly touted prospects in high school basketball was a gentleman by the name of RJ Hampton. RJ Hampton said, I'm not going to college. He went to play professional basketball in Australia. In fact, he and his team just played against the Grizzlies in the NBA preseason. So when he was playing in that Nike National AAU tournament, a tournament that's sponsored by Gatorade, sponsored by Mountain Dew, sponsored by Pepsi, you should have paid him. Because he wasn't going to NCAA. Should have paid him. But if you paid him, that would have jeopardized his high school eligibility. Oh, my point exactly. If you're going to tackle the system, go after it for real. Don't make the NCAA out to be a scapegoat when you are just as complicit. That's my only beef. The NCAA is the fucking getaway driver, dog. As a man that's been in that building. In fact, they do more to give back than any of these magazines and ESPNs and Nikes. They got all types of programs that help the student athlete. Nobody else is doing that. So please, LeBron, it's disingenuous to just go after a peon in this whole system. It needs to be revamped. I told you guys I went to Europe this year and they scoffed at the idea that we have high school sports. What? If there's a talented 11, 12-year-olds, they put them in the academy, feed them, clothe them, give them some money, and help them reach the professional ranks. The chamarism or the idea that it's amateur sports here in America is a joke. And the NCAA is only a piece to the problem. I want to leave that right there. Now, I do want to talk about some of this NBA and China stuff. When it first came out, the Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey got in trouble for a tweet he put out. He tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." Now, I thought this was just another case of American arrogance, America thinking their way is the best way. You know, American arrogance usually comes in the form of a male, an older male, an older white male, thinking their way is the best way. Even though I cringe every time I hear that, because I'm like, yo, which metric are you using? I mean, we got one of the biggest national debts. We don't lead in healthy living or lifespan or infant mortality rates or healthcare. Like, we don't lead in any of those metrics, yet you guys think we're the best. But okay, whatever. But then I saw the Houston Rockets owner distance himself from those comments. I saw the story really start to pick up steam. And I'm like, damn, well, there's smoke, there's fire. So essentially what's going on is Morey tweeted his support for some Hong Kong protesters. Hong Kong is a nation that's looking to free itself from China and its authoritarian rule. I guess there are some real crimes against humanity going on. Like, all this stuff I didn't know. And still in all, the NBA is over there doing business. And a lot of people are asking why. You know, the NBA that fancies itself as a league that's about equality and human rights, why are they still doing business with this nation? And one of my friends, he spent many years in China working in youth basketball academies. And I got a glimpse into China's rule through him. I would send him YouTube links and he's like, yo, well, I can't watch that. The government said no. So that's just a piece of, I guess, the snuffing out of free speech. And that's just the innocuous stuff. I heard there's some real violent, underbelly, nasty stuff going on. And I'm going to see if I could get him on the line, see if he can help us out. All right, right now on the line, I got a good friend of mine. He spent multiple years working in China and some youth academies. We actually are going to use his alias, Little Bill, in all seriousness, because we don't want the Chinese government to be mad at him. But he only got a few minutes. Brother, how you doing?
Everything good, man.
Good. Let me ask you a question. What is Hong Kong fighting for?
Well, Hong Kong fighting for civil liberties. The agreement China made with the UK was to allow Hong Kong to be semi-autonomous until 2047.
Right.
So that would have made the... they still have a few years to go, you know? That was 1997. It was a 50-year thing. But China already started imposing its will in Hong Kong. So the youth there, being the future of the country, they hit in the streets. They protesting.
Okay, what civil liberties do they not have? Like, what crimes against humanity are being committed?
Well, already China has been... they've been doing such things as going in and disappearing people who speak out against Chinese government.
Just disappearing? Like, they ain't here anymore?
Well, they go. They might come knock on your door at midnight, you know. Plainclothes police that from mainland. And they go. They take you. They drive you across the border into Shenzhen. And they jail you there. And no one knows where you're at. And then what they'll do is they'll make you appear on TV about 2 or 3 months later, and you confessed to doing something wrong, when really you didn't. You were just exercising your rights that you have in Hong Kong that don't exist in mainland China.
Okay, now, China is a communist nation, correct?
Correct.
Now, years ago, Jay-Z and Beyonce, they went to Cuba, and the State Department was upset with them. Because, listen, America, we don't mess with Cuba. They're communists. We don't want their Cuban cigars here. China is a communist place also, right? And Jay-Z said this in a line once. He said, this communist talk is so confusing when it's from China, the very mic that I'm using. How come China does not get the same bad rap here in the States the way Cuba does?
Well, I can't really... I don't know what the correct answer for that is, but in my opinion, China is... we have to be careful what we say about China due to the power that China has. So right now, China flexes its muscles. It's one of our biggest trade partners.
So it's like the money.
Setting his line.
So it's the money.
It comes from China. Yeah, it's money. It's money. Absolutely. Profits, profits, profits. And that's China knows that America is greedy.
So this is the last question I have for you. The NBA fancies itself as a league that is about human rights, that is about equality. We saw when they had that racist owner, Donald Sterling, they wasted no time getting him out of there. Can the NBA still carry itself as a leader in human rights and do business with China?
That's a good question. They can, but the NBA is about viewership and profits. So it won't be the same. Already today, there was an article that came out that the salary cap would decrease 10% if China goes through with this ban.
So, Bill, listen. So the NBA's devotion to equality and human rights is only in place when it doesn't affect the bottom line. Is that what you're telling me?
That's what we're going to see. This is the biggest test.
This is the biggest test for the league, huh?
This is the biggest test. Because we have to understand that China has 400 million fans. How many people living in the U.S.?
Right.
About 330 million.
Right.
So they have more people that are actually tuning in, watching, streaming, buying jerseys, going to games. They travel here. I know of Chinese friends that come to San Francisco, they want to watch the Warriors. They're going out to Houston. They want to watch the Rockets. And they bring in a family, and they're spending money to sit close to have that experience. So it's going to be a big test. Can it go on without China? Yes, absolutely. But there's big history there, and there's a lot of money there, and it's going to be the biggest test.
That's just heartbreaking to know that the league is, you know, they really fancied themselves. They really made a way with equality and we take care of the community. And to see them do business in a nation that you said they making people disappear, that's heartbreaking.
Yep, I agree. It's very heartbreaking.
It's like
it's like a game that's the way things work over there are much different. Their mentality, their approach to things, daily life is much different. So it's a lot of things we have to take into account when we talk about the situation. But all in all, I do think the NBA, you know, can prosper without it.
But it seems like they don't want to prosper without it. You know, the Chinese government is canceling game. I mean, they're not televising games. They're ripping down posters. And the NBA is still over there. What are they waiting for to come back home?
they want to make amends.
They want to make that money. Now, let me ask you this. Has any of the NBA stars, has LeBron James, has anybody tweeted anything significant? It seems like everybody's just playing the corporate line and they playing it safe. Has anybody said anything significant?
No, you, man. I knew you were going to call somebody out. But I haven't seen that.
Damn.
You know, we speak out against people of color being shot down. You know, the I am Trayvon t-shirt.
Right.
All Lives Matter,
right.
Things of that. So, honestly, it's not their, in a way, it is their duty to come out. You know, LeBron James, who I'm a big fan of, and he always advocates for civil rights and things of that nature. Is it his duty as the face of the league? Yeah. Yeah. Has he came out? No. But it's going to take the top guys, the Adam Silvers and the owners.
Right.
It's not only a LeBron James thing.
Right. But it hurts to see them do business with a place that is not doing the right thing. I'm going to get you out of here on this. I want you to tell the audience what you told me about how funny it was that they are upset about a Twitter message.
Oh, so what I said was they're upset about a Twitter message when in China you cannot have Twitter. You cannot use Twitter without a VPN. VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. So that's their way of getting around the great firewall that they have.
Twitter's outlawed.
Yeah. Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. The social medias we have, those outlets, they have their own. Weibo. They have
stuff that they control, I bet.
Stuff that they could control.
All right, brother. Thank you, man. I'm gonna let you get out of here.
Anytime, my man.
All right, later. That was my boy Little Bill. And I'm serious, man. We using his alias because in case he goes back and does some of those youth basketball camps, we don't want the Chinese government to hold a grudge against him and withhold his passport and not give him a visa. Like, that's the type of stuff that goes on, man. They have rabid ears. I told you I would send him links to YouTube videos and he couldn't watch it. So you heard it right there from somebody that was on the Saul. Some crazy things going on. And the NBA's out there getting that coin. And I don't fault them. You know, this is a capitalist world. But don't carry yourself as if you are pure, if you are about the people. Because it wasn't until this year, 2019, at the ripe old age of 34, that I realized activism and capitalism are not the same. You know, I was raised by Jay-Z. I thought they were one and the same. Like, you get money, yeah, you can help your people. But sometimes getting that money comes at the cost of your people, right? Nelson Mandela spending 20 years in prison, that ain't capitalism. You know, I'm sure there were people that wanted to pay Martin Luther King off during his crusade. But nah, son. Activism and capitalism are two separate things, man. And it's interesting to see how the NBA is going to handle this. But I'm sure the NFL is relieved. They're probably like, finally, the NBA got itself in some trouble, man. We're not the only ones that's about to check. Because for so long, the NBA got to get off scot-free. You know, they got to get behind social injustice moves, and it helped their bottom line. We'll see how they handle this. Now, I want to stay on that side of the globe. In South Korea, there was a golfer by the name of, I believe, B.O. Kim. He was playing in the Korean golf tournament. And during his swing, someone snapped a picture. Kind of messed up his swing. He turned around in frustration and gave the crowd the middle finger. The administrators out there suspended him for 3 years. 3 years. This was the leading moneymaker for that tour. You would think the leading moneymaker is the best player. They suspended him. They voted unanimously. Get him out of here. And you know what? The golfer is not going to contest that ruling. Now, Will, you say, what do you think about that? I don't have a real opinion. But what I do have is an observation. And this situation, to me, it just highlights what that country, that culture, what they deem most important, which is respect. Now, here in America, the way we react to situation, it highlights what we hold most important. And what do we hold important? Money. Right? In America, you could be vulgar, you could be a liar, a cheater, drug abuser, abuse your wife. If you could produce money for somebody, if you're talented enough to bring in the coins, we'll forgive you. But in Korea, they said, listen, son, we don't care how much money you make. You're not going to act that way. We're a culture based off honor and respect. And that doesn't fly. And with the golfer not contesting the ruling shows that he believes it as well. There was a story that came out when he left the facility that day. He kneeled before the media as a way of apologizing. Right? You think his family cares that he makes, they're probably so ashamed and embarrassed because that's how their culture goes. So that's it for me. It was just an observation like, wow. They said, man, forget all that money stuff. You will not bring shame to us. You will not embarrass us. In America, it's a little bit different. Dog, do whatever you want. We're going to give you 100 chances as long as you keep raking in that dough. And in fact, keeping with Korea, I read this in a Malcolm Gladwell book. It was about the Korean Airlines, right? Korean Airlines, they kept having issues with their flights. Like there were crashes, there were accidents. In fact, between 1970 and 1999, over 700 lives were lost due to accidents. In the year 1999, there were 3 crashes alone, right? So the rest of the world is like, yo, what the hell is going on with Korean Airlines? What is the problem? So finally, Korean Airlines, they let some outsiders take a look. And they're like, man, are their pilots inferior? Nope. They were trained to the T. The pilots were good. Like, is the equipment inferior? Nope. This stuff is up to par too. What the outsiders came to learn is they were having issues with crashes because of their culture, right? Because again, in that culture, respect is most important. So in a plane, you have a pilot and you have his first mate, which is kind of like second in command. They are there to watch over each other and look after each other. But in the instance of these crashes, the first mate didn't feel comfortable challenging the lead pilot because of their culture. It's about respect. That man outranks you. You watch the way you speak to him. You watch the way you address him. So when the first mate should say, yo, pilot, those wings are frozen. We ain't flying. He would be like, Mr. Pilot, I don't think we should fly. And the lead pilot might ignore him or not take him seriously. And the plane would go up and it would crash. Seriously, the pilots were trained well. The equipment was up to par. It was a cultural, I guess, quality that was stifling this airline. No lie. So they retrained him. And now Korean Airlines is doing well. You see, in America, we ain't got that problem. That second pilot would have been like, yo, listen, dog, we ain't flying in this weather, Captain. I don't care what you outrank me. But the Korean culture is one that holds respect as paramount above everything. And in the case of the flying, it was to their detriment. So that's it. Just an observation. And in fact, I told that story to one of my friends. The last time I saw him, he was a pilot. He was impressed that I knew the story about the Korean Airlines. I guess during his training here in America, that a case study came up. He's like, damn, well, how you know that, man? That's my man, Chris Copeland. Rest in peace. Now, I want to move to these Yankees, man. The New York Yankees just got out of the first round beating the Minnesota Twins. And I got an issue and apology to the Yankees general manager, Mr. Brian Cashman. I expressed my frustration with him because he neglected to go get the Yankees an ace. He neglected to get them a star pitcher. But as I've expressed on this show before, that self-awareness is a great quality. And no matter what acquisitions Brian Cashman would have made, he would have never been able to acquire a staff that could match up with the Houston Astros, Justin Verlander, Garrett Cole, and Zach Greinke. So what I believe Mr. Cashman did was, we're going to make our strength of having heavy bats, we're going to make it such a strength that hopefully it'll carry us to the finish line. We already got Aaron Judge. He went and got Giancarlo Stanton. He went and got Encarnacion. He went and got Maybin. He brought up Gleyber Torres. He brought up Gary Sanchez. It seems that he said, listen, we're never going to win the pitching duel, so let's just make our batting lineup the best it can be. And then stock our bullpen with middle relievers. Conley, Chad Green, Zach Britton. And of course, the greatest closer in the game right now, my man, the Cuban Missile, Aroldis Chapman. It seemed that that's what his plan. And in the first round, it worked out. The first game, the Yankees won 10-4. With the starter, Paxton, only going four innings. Said, listen, dog, it's okay if our starter isn't up to snuff. We got the middle relievers. We got the bats. The second game, Yankees won 8-2 over the Twins. Starting pitcher Tanaka only goes five innings. Don't worry. Again, we got the middle relievers. We got the bats. And then this last game, they won 5-1 with Luis Severino, the starting pitcher, only going four innings. It don't matter. We got the middle relievers. And we got the ability to score runs. And I must admit, I like this setup. Because these baseball games are marathons. So when we go up against the Astros or whoever it might be, they might have the edge with the starter. But that starter's only sticking around for 6-7 innings. If we could weather that storm, right? If we could beat them down with our potent lineup, we got a good chance to win the World Series, man. And I must admit, I like what I saw. And I am excited for this next round. Now, one player that was not with the Yankees this last series was their pitcher, CeCe Sabathia. Unfortunately, he had a shoulder injury. Hopefully, he can rejoin the club in the upcoming rounds. Now, this is going to be CeCe's last run with the team. He has announced his retirement. First off, from a fan's perspective, you know, CeCe was just tough, man. He came up with the Indians, won a Cy Young. They traded him right before free agency. He went to Milwaukee in the trade, helped carry the Brewers to the playoffs. In fact, that was 2008, the very last game of that season. He pitched a complete game, four-hitter against the Cubs, which allowed the Brewers to go to the playoffs. Like, just tough, man. One game takes all. He was just fearless, man. Complete game. Give me the ball. Get out my way. He moved on to the Yankees 2009, signed the richest contract for a pitcher ever, 7 years, $161 million. And after getting that money, he performed. Let the Yankees to the World Series 2009. Like, that's tough, man. You go get the richest contract for a pitcher ever and then proceed to perform. That's my kind of guy, man. And he's always been that pitcher. For me, and I could be wrong, you know, throw some names at me. CeCe was the first hip-hop baseball player. You know, I mean, we had Barry Bonds and Ken Griffey, but those guys were the offspring of former major leaguers. They grew up in the clubhouse. You know, they had a different path to where they went. But CeCe, he was tattoos and Jordan sneakers. Like, word, my man CeCe would be on the mound in some Jordan cleats. Like, dead ass, man. That's who he represented to me and my friends. Man, just the hood, tough, rugged, and got it done. And even as he got older and the velocity slowed down, he had the toughness and the mental fortitude to reinvent himself. You know, there are stories about how he would communicate with Andy Pettit, another lefty. I'm like, yo, Pettit, how do I pitch at this stage in my career where the velocity may not be there? And they worked on different things. They learned the cutter, and CeCe had a bounce back year in 2017 with a 14-5 record after going 9-12 the year before. Like, that's just tough, man. Like, there's something to say about people that just find a way to get it done. And that's who CeCe always represented to me. Now, as somebody who had the privilege of spending a season with him and the Yankees in 2017, it was amazing. You know, I've driven limousines and I've been with all types of celebrities. And sometimes you meet somebody that you know from television and you're disappointed. Like, damn, my favorite actor is a dumbass. You know what I'm saying? But with CeCe, he was the real deal. He was the real deal. In fact, when I took the position with the Yankees, I was excited because, you know, I had desires of being with Roc Nation. I mean, Jay-Z's doing sports. He's from Brooklyn. I'm from Brooklyn. Like, it's a perfect match. And CeCe was a Roc Nation client. So, you know, I'm like, dang, man, you never know what rooms I might find myself in. And so in looking to take the Yankee position, you know, CeCe was always on my radar. But just working alongside him was phenomenal. And no matter who you were in that clubhouse, he was solid with you. And everybody loves him. No matter what request he made, I would go to my supervisor. I'm like, yo, CeCe looking for those plates, those tickets behind home plate for his family. My supervisor like, yo, get it done. That's CeCe, that's number 50. Get it done. Yo, he looking for a couple hats for his home. Get it done. You know what I mean? We work hard for all the athletes, but there was a little extra pep in our step when the big lefty came calling. And another thing that was cool to see was to see the respect his peers paid to him. You know, they're all major leaguers. They're all making money, yet they know CeCe's the big homie. And their respect for him comes from not only was he a great baseball player, not only did he get paid, but he did it all in the Big Apple. Under the brightest lights, which isn't always easy to navigate. You know, we look at his teammate, Domingo Herman. You know, before his career even got off the ground, he finds himself in some domestic violence trouble. CeCe seems to have it all figured out and doing a great job of managing it. You know, what he does on the field. He cashing big paychecks. His family is beautiful. He got the charity, the Pitching Foundation, being led by his beautiful wife, Amber Sabathia. Like, he seems to have it all intact. And it was just amazing to watch fellow baseball players look up to him and hang on to his words and his experiences. But like, yo, this brother did it. I'll tell you a story. Back in 2017, when we were in Houston, lost game 7 against the Astros, a game that would have took the Yankees to the World Series. We're downstairs in the locker room. The guys got dressed. Under these stadiums, like, it's a long way between where the locker room is and where you have to go to the bus. So sometimes guys jump in carts and somebody will drive them to the bus. So I was in a cart with CeCe, and we driving past the Houston Astros locker room, champagne flowing, like no exaggeration. Like they in there celebrating, yelling, cheering, you hear the music, and then somebody comes chasing after the cart. Who was it? The Astros starting pitcher that day, Justin Verlander. He came out there to salute CeCe Sabathia. Hey, man, great job. And I'm like, wow, that was phenomenal to see. Here Justin Verlander is. He just won the biggest game of his career. He's about to go to the World Series. He's with his teammates, popping champagne, hanging. But he found time to come out and salute CeCe Sabathia, man. Because they know CeCe worked himself back from injury. They know CeCe reinvented himself after he got older to earn the ability to pitch Game 7 for the New York Yankees. So it's cool when you see people saluted by their peers, man. I wish, I couldn't believe it, son. Like, this is a cool moment. And I was fortunate to see it. So I just want to send the big lefty some love, man. Appreciate him from a fan's perspective, entertaining us for years. Appreciate him for just being great to me while I was in the clubhouse running around. CeCe's the general of that clubhouse, man. Like his influence and his presence is going to be missed dearly. And I ain't even talking about on the field. Those players, they know they can go to him for anything. They trust him to help guide and navigate them throughout their career. And management, they know that, yo, this is CeCe's show. They know with him at the helm, they ain't got to worry about too much. Back in 2017, when I was working with the club, you know, my friends and I, we would argue about different things, about the Yankees. I mean, just as fans. Just because I'm in the building, don't change that. But there were two topics I refused to go back and forth with them on. I said, listen, man, take my inside information and just know this is it. One of those things was I told him, listen, the manager, he ain't coming back. And Fenton be like, yo, but Will, man, this team just played really well. You know, we almost made it to the... Fenton, DA, he ain't coming back, son. And sure enough, that manager didn't return. And the second thing that I was hell-bent on was CeCe Sabathia is not going anywhere. But yo, Will, he had a great year. The Minnesota Twins are interested. They might drop it back. CeCe Sabathia ain't going anywhere. Nobody in that organization is letting him walk away. He's too valuable. You know, so whatever they paid him, he was worth every penny, man. If you look at the Washington Wizards of the NBA, they paid Gilbert Arenas $111 million, but he got caught up in that silly gun charge and gun case with Jarvis Crittenden, and it derailed that franchise for years. You know, his $111 million contract down the drain, add in the bad PR, and it cost that organization money upon money. If they had a veteran in that clubhouse, if they had a leader in that clubhouse like CeCe Sabathia, you don't think they would have paid him 10, 20, whatever million. He would have been worth it because he would have saved you all that heartache on the back end. So when fans, they look at individuals and they start to calculate a contract, if he's worth this on the field or not, you got to take into account all that they do for that organization. And when you calculate that, CeCe earned every penny. Shit, he might be underpaid. So salute to him. I'm sure he is not going too far from the New York City area. He's got a great foundation here called the Pitching Foundation. They're doing a lot of amazing things. In fact, I had the privilege of helping them out a few weeks ago. We packed some backpacks with some school supplies. Man, just doing great work all around. To me, CeCe is one of those athletes that I deem as kind of like flawless. On the field performance, check. Made his money, check. Family intact, beautiful, check. Charitable efforts, Like, I wouldn't even put Michael Jordan in that category because, you know, Mike got some stuff in his past where he punched a teammate. They all talk about his gambling and he got a divorce. Not that that's a negative thing. It's just it ain't flawless. I think CeCe's one of those guys that pull it off. I wouldn't even know who else I would put in that category. Shit, maybe Grant Hill. You know what I'm saying? Every time we seen Grant Hill, he got busy. College, NBA, married to Mia, he's broadcasting, he's a part owner. Like, they just hit it out the park, man. Wait, just think about it. When you in a circle with your friends, who got a bad thing to say about CeCe or Grant Hill, man? Phenomenal career, man. Salute to the big lefty. I want to get into this NFL weekend. We had a couple good games. I had the privilege of watching two of them from start to finish. One of those games was the Monday night matchup between the Cleveland Browns and the San Francisco 49ers. The Browns suck. And this is the first time I'm commenting on them. But they're just a bad team. You have Odell Beckham Jr., one of the most dynamic playmakers in the game, and you got him in the backfield trying to do handoffs and end-arounds. Man, you better get that boy out in the open field so he can make plays. He ain't a running back. That's the most I've ever seen Odell Beckham Jr. take the ball out of the backfield, and he's been in New York for years. That just shows a lack of creativity. That just highlights a lack of ability by his quarterback. Because his quarterback can't be trusted to get him the ball. So let's run some end arounds and some handoffs just so the ball could touch his hands and hopefully magic can happen. That's bad. I ain't even talking about whether they won or lost. I'm just talking about the way they go about conducting their business. It was ugly. And as for that quarterback, Baker Mayfield, 8 for 22, 2 interceptions. Eight for 22 is 36%, right? That's not doing a good job of getting the ball to your receivers. And the reason I think his percentage is so low, because when you see him drop back, it seems like he holds the ball more than any quarterback I've ever seen. He's holding the ball. He's scrambling. He's trying to make the home run play. Either that or he needs his wide receivers to be wide open for him to feel comfortable throwing the ball. You see, the great quarterbacks like Drew Brees, they throw the ball before their wide receiver even turns his head to locate it. Have you ever seen it? It's phenomenal. It's like they got fucking brainwaves connected. They throw the ball, and when the wide receiver turns his shoulder to look, oh, there it goes. Baker Mayfield doesn't seem to have that skill of anticipation. He doesn't seem to be able to forward think in that regard. And that's why his receivers are not open. In his mind, that's why he's scrambling for his life the whole game. That's why he's getting sacked. He has the ball in his hand too long because he doesn't have the ability to anticipate when his receivers will be open. Speaking of sacks, did you see when Nick Bosa sacked him? My God. Nick Bosa is a monster. He had 2 sacks, 2 tackles for loss, and a fumble recovery. Nick Bosa looked like a monster on Monday Night Football. Do you know how hard it is to stand out on a football field full of tough, strong people? Do you know how hard it is to separate yourself? Well, shit, that's what Nick Bosa did Monday night. He looked like a monster amongst men. So he tackles Baker Mayfield, and he does a celebration that mimics what Baker Mayfield did way back in college when he went into Nick Bosa's Ohio State and defeated them. And Baker Mayfield grabbed his school flag, Oklahoma's flag, and slammed it in the middle of Ohio State's field. So I thought it was pretty cool of Nick Bosa to remember that, to bring it back. I thought it was cool. It was classy. The timing was perfect. Like, dog, I remember what you did. And now we playing on the greatest stage in professional football, and I got you back. But I want to go back to that celebration by Baker Mayfield. And I want to ask you, because, you know, I want to talk about the psychological profile of a winner. What big winner have you ever seen celebrate to that degree? I can't think of too many. I can't think of when Michael Jordan wins a big game. I don't see the rubbing it in his opponent's face. I don't see him jumping for joy as if he just won the lottery. I don't see that from Tom Brady. I didn't see that from Derek Jeter. The psychological profile of a winner, I think the really big winners are more on an even playing field. I think after they have great victories like that, first off, they expect that. They hold themselves to that standard. They walk into the arena expecting to win that. So after they have accomplished their mission, why would they be shocked and surprised? Why would they feel such jubilation? Actually, what they should feel is relief. If you really believe you are that great and you should win that game. So to see Baker Mayfield celebrate like a little boy, I'm not asking you if it's right or wrong. I'm asking you, have you ever seen that from a big winner? I don't think they have that quality. They too focus on being greater for tomorrow. They're too busy being relieved that they have accomplished the thing they walked in there hell-bent on accomplishment. They're too relieved that they've accomplished the thing they've been working for so diligently. There's no shock. There's no surprise. There's no jubilation. It's relief. Staying with the psychological profile of a winner, Baker Mayfield. You see him kind of, I guess, have rabbit ears, and he's the kind of guy that takes offense when people speak negatively about him. And he'll be like, you know what? We'll show them. Or he'll say things like, yo, now he's really motivated. He's motivated by the naysayers. And I ask you, which big winner have you ever heard speak like that? Huh? Because when you have those guys that, oh, because somebody spoke down about them, now they're motivated. Now they're at that peak. When you have guys that have those peaks, guess what? With those peaks come valleys. That's why you see their gameplay go up and down. The great ones are motivated from the door. Right? I don't need you to talk bad about me and now I'm ready to prepare and train. You always hear them talk about Michael Jordan like, yo, he was motivated by the naysayers. I think that's slightly exaggerated. But in fact, not slightly, majorly exaggerated. When Michael Jordan won championship 3, 4, 5, 6, nobody was speaking down at him. He had the world in his palm. Yet he still chased championship number 6 with the same fervor that he chased 1. How many chips Derek Jeter got? Ain't nobody said a bad word about him in 15 years, yet he was still chasing because there aren't peaks and valleys. There's a steady desire to be great. It never wavers. So be wary of those guys that go up and down and chip on their shoulder and they got rabbit ears and, oh, now we're motivated. I remember playing and I'm like, yo, don't give them guys any material. Listen, if they need bullet board material to get ready, they already lost. Because when I walk in the gym, when I go to prepare, I'm already preparing as if you talked about my mama. I don't, you know what I'm saying? I don't need adversity to strike for. Okay, guys, now I'm ready. And I tell you, I've been reading a lot, seeing different things. And it's cool to come across things that are said in the book that you've always believed. And one of the books I read recently had this quote. The most powerful work is done in response to an opportunity, not in response to a problem. You hear me? The opportunity is what motivates the great ones, not the problem. The other game I got to catch was the Sunday night game, Chiefs versus the Colts. With the Colts, I guess, pulling off the upset, winning 19-13. First with the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes. This is what Troy Aikman was speaking about when he said, yo, hold your horses when you compare me to Patrick Mahomes. He got a long way to go. Because Patrick Mahomes seemed to have hurt his ankle in that game, and he wasn't the same player. Well, yeah, well, one of his greatest attributes, his speed, was taken away. So what? Troy Aikman and the quarterbacks before him have gotten off the pavement many a times, had to overcome injuries and adversity. And Patrick Mahomes' first sign, he didn't do too well. His first test, he didn't get it done. So hold your horses. There's something to be said about the older guys, Troy Aikman, getting up after concussion and handling business. There's something to be said for that. Respect it. Patrick Mahomes is magnificent. But in a game that they should have won against a quarterback who is not as revered as Patrick Mahomes, he should have got it done. Ankle hurt or nah. But credit to the Colts. They did a good job of controlling time of possession. The Colts are led by another young, talented brother at quarterback, Jacoby Brissett. Now, Brissett was thrusted into the spotlight after Andrew Luck's abrupt retirement during training camp. And I wanted to know if you guys knew this fun fact about Jacoby Brissett. He negotiates his own contract, where Jay-Z represents athletes, right? Black owned business. Where LeBron put his boy Rich Paul in place, cool, black owned business, keeping the money in house. Jacoby Brissett took it a step further. Dog, I'm negotiating my own money. And he recently signed a 2-year, $30 million deal with the Colts after Andrew Luck's retirement. I think that story is phenomenal. In the middle of training camp, he went upstairs with the general manager to talk business. So when these athletes try to sell you, yo, I'm so busy, man, I just got so much going, what's more important than your business affairs, than your personal matters? Football, right? Training camp with your teammates. Go upstairs, negotiate your contract. It can be done. So when we let these athletes off the hook, Jacoby Brissett is showing that we can hold them to a higher standard. This man ain't a lawyer. He ain't legally trained. But he goes up there and sits across from the table and negotiates. And when asked why he negotiates, he said, I quote, I don't like people to bullshit on my behalf, end quote. Simple and succinct. Kudos to that man. But I want to ask you, how hard would it be to negotiate your own contract, though? for both parties, for him and the organization. Because when you think about negotiations, everybody's trying to get what they want. So where an organization would tell an agent, hey, I don't think your player warrants this contract because he's not as good as the other guys. He's not as fast. He's not as strong. An agent can take that information and go tell the player, maybe clean it up, maybe not make it sound so harsh as to not deflate their ego. If a player is speaking head to head with the organization, it's got to be tough to hear them, I guess, wrestle back and forward over different things or explain to your face why you're not worth $100 million. Right? But kudos to Mr. Brissett. Ladies and gentlemen, when I was going through the process and deciding whether or not I should join the United States Army, I sought the counsel of one man and one man only. That gentleman is joining us right now on the podcast. My friend, my confidant, my brother, original lowlife. And no, I'm not denigrating my friend. Lowlife refers to guys that wear a lot of polo. You get it. My brother, Kamoy McDonald. K-Mac, what's good, man?
Yo, what's up, everybody? What's up? What's up? How y'all doing?
Yo, so I'm glad to have you on the show, finally. This week, I reached out to you. I said, yo, Mac, I need you on the podcast, man. Tell the people, what was your response?
Yeah, I'm not really that much of an extrovert to be having my voice heard like that. I recently started being a little bit more active on my Twitter, and that's about it.
So
I was a little reluctant.
Nah, man, we home, son. It's all good, man. In fact, I got some warm-up questions for you. We're going to be right in your wheelhouse. When we grew up, it was Saturday morning cartoons, Batman, Spider-Man, and we kept that through adulthood. And yeah. A few years ago, the comic book superhero community was up in arms because they let Ben Affleck play Batman. How mad are you at that selection?
I didn't care at all, really. I didn't care at all for a few reasons. One that's most memorable right now is the setting that DC was going with, you know, was in the future. Batman seems to be a little bit older and a little bit more gruff. So based on the comic book that they were doing the movie off of, I didn't see what was wrong with it, because in the comic book, Batman was a little bit more older, a little bit more gruff, a little bit more jaded, upset. I think he lost a few of his sidekicks.
He lost a few homies along the way.
Yeah, definitely lost a few homies along the way, and they even showed it in the movie. So
Ben Affleck was kind of the right choice, huh? If you know the history of the comic books and everything, like, it was kind of fitting.
Yeah, it was kind of fitting for the setting. Him being old, gruff, etc., you know, jaded.
See?
And Ben Affleck didn't do a bad job. as far as physically how he looked in the costume, he didn't do bad at all.
Okay, see, that's why I bring you on.
In my opinion.
You guys know the history. I only know the stuff that I see on TV. Y'all know all the comic books and what's not shown on the movies and television. So that's an assessment I never heard, that movie took place in the future and Ben Affleck was actually a character that was kind of in line with the storyline. But what I want to ask you about...
In the future, meaning like Batman was a little bit older, so it happened like, you know, after the times, not in the future, like, you know, the year 2100.
Right. Right.
You know?
I got you.
And it was also like a separate writer and all that stuff.
I want to ask you about this Joker flick. I didn't see it. I will see it this weekend, hopefully, if not the weekend after. But it's doing well at the box office, and I want to get your take on it. How was the movie?
The movie was fantastic, man. It's a really I in my opinion, it's a slow-paced movie, and it should be. It depicts his origin. And it's not an origin like from childhood. No, it just shows like a snapshot, literally, of what happens in a person's life that could cause them to do something that's obviously horrendous and be a horrendous person. That's about it.
Got you. Now, this is what I really wanted to ask you. Okay, going back 1990, there's a Batman movie. Batman is played by Michael Keaton. The Joker is played by Jack Nicholson. Jack Nicholson went on to be a great Hollywood actor. We know him from The Shining. We know him from A Few Good Men. Okay, cool.
The Departed, I believe.
Right. He did a great job. Fast forward 2008, Heath Ledger. We know about his portrayal of the Joker. He did a great job. It ultimately cost him his life. And now we move forward to this movie. Joaquin Phoenix, everybody's saying he's doing a great job. Now, Mac, how much of the credit goes to the actor? Or is it just so that the Joker is a character that we can't take our eyes off? He's homicidal, maniacal, suicidal. Just how much of it goes to the actor? Because they get credit time after time. And how much of it is just the writing and the Joker being a character that is must-see TV?
All right. Okay, so let's say that starting from the top, you know, when the movie's released, everybody's gonna go and see it, even if it's, you know, even if it's a corny movie. But when you have a movie that has like such a well known, like, you know, goes down in history, one of the most known villains of all time, which is the Joker.
For sure.
Of course, people are gonna come out and see it, right? So let's get that out of the way. Now, I think that a lot of credit to a particular movie, an overwhelming majority of it may go to the actor. And I feel that is the case in especially these Marvel movies and other movies, but since we're talking about Marvel and DC right now, because some of the acts, like Jared Leto played the Joker, and everybody done forgot about Jared Leto. His role in the Suicide Squad was trash. Absolute trash. I fell asleep watching that movie. I've only fallen asleep watching like less than 10 movies in my life. The first movie was Dumb and Dumberer. And I remember watching that in Hinesville, Georgia, while I was in the Army. That was the first movie I fell asleep on. So anyway, Jared Leto, watching him play Joker, that was absolute trash. His acting in it was trash. That Joker was trash. Now, a portion of that could be at fault of the writers too and the directors, because they might have wanted Jared Leto to lean a certain way, to be a certain type of Joker. But because we don't know what happens behind the scenes so much, we could only see the final product and who's playing a part in the final product, have to blame the actor. Jared Leto's Joker was trash. So even though Heath Ledger is only, you know, not to say only to take away his success, but, you know, he's Heath Ledger. A lot of people eventually flocked to that movie because they heard the accolades Heath Ledger got for playing such a compelling Joker.
I got you.
So I think most of the accolades goes to the actor in the final product.
Because I'm starting to feel that, yo, if you put me in a Joker costume, I might win an Oscar.
Nah, doubt it. Doubt it.
All right, man. I just wanted to get your take on that. Thanks for joining the show, man. We got to have you back again.
No doubt. I'm here.
That's WBA Sports Radio. Your host, William Holly. Follow me on Twitter at WBH Radio. On Instagram at WBH Radio. Until next time, man, we out.